Chapter 23. Was it heaven or hell? A Cure for the Blues. By courtesy of Mr. Cable, I came into possession of a singular book 8 or 10 years ago. It is likely that mine is now the only copy in existence. Its title page, unabbreviated, reads as follows. The Enemy Conquered, or Love Triumphant. By G. Ragsdale McClintock. 1. Author of an address, apostrophe etc., delivered at Sunflower Hill, South Carolina, and member of the Yale Law School, New Haven. Published by T.H. Peace, 83 Chapel Street, 1845. No one can take up this book and lay it down again unread. Whoever reads one line of it is caught, is chained. He has become the contented slave of its fascinations, and he will read and read. Devour, and devour, and will not let it go out of his hand till it is finished to the last line, though the house be on fire over his head. And after a first reading he will not throw it aside, but will keep it by him, with his Shakespeare and his Homer, and will take it up many and many a time, when the world is dark, and his spirits are low, and be straightway cheered and refreshed. Yet this work has been allowed to lie wholly neglected, unmentioned, and apparently unregretted, for nearly half a century. The reader must not imagine that he is to find in it wisdom, brilliancy, fertility of invention, ingenuity of construction, excellence of form, purity of style, perfection of imagery, truth to nature, clearness of statement, humanly possible situations, humanly possible people, fluent narrative, connected sequence of events or philosophy, or logic, or sense. No, the rich, deep, beguiling charm of the book lies in the total and miraculous absence from it of all these qualities, a charm which is completed and perfected by the evident fact that the author, whose naive innocence easily and surely wins our regard and almost our worship, does not know that they are absent, does not even suspect that they are absent. When read by the light of these helps to an understanding of the situation, the book is delicious, profoundly and satisfyingly delicious. I call it a book, because the author calls it a book. I call it a work, because he calls it a work. But, in truth, it is merely a duodecimo pamphlet of 31 pages. It was written for fame and money, as the author very frankly yes, and very hopefully too. Poor fellow says in his preface, the money never came, no penny of it ever came, and how long, how pathetically long, the fame has been deferred, 47 years. He was young then, it would have been so much to him then, but will he care for it now? As time is measured in America, McClintock's epoch is antiquity. In his long vanished day the Southern author had a passion for eloquence. It was his pet, his darling. He would be eloquent, or perish. And he recognized only one kind of eloquence, the lurid, the tempestuous, the volcanic. He liked words, big words, fine words, grand words, rumbling, thundering, reverberating words, with sense attaching, if it could be got in without marring the sound, but not otherwise. He loved to stand up before a dazed world, and pour forth flame and smoke and lava and pumice stone into the skies, and work his subterranean thunders, and shake himself with earthquakes, and stench himself with sulfur fumes. If he consumed his own fields and vineyards, that was a pity, yes, but he would have his eruption at any cost. Mr. McClintock's eloquence, and he is always eloquent, his crater is always spouting, is of the pattern common to his day, but he departs from the custom of the time in one respect. His brethren allowed sense to intrude when it did not mar the sound, but he does not allow it to intrude at all. For example, consider this figure, which he used in the village address referred to with such candid complacency in the title page above quoted, "Hike the topmost topaz of an ancient tower. Please read it again, contemplate it, measure it, walk around it, climb up it, try to get at an approximate realization of the size of it. Is the fellow to that to be found in literature, ancient or modern, foreign or domestic, living or dead, drunk or sober? One notices how fine and grand it sounds. We know that, if it was loftily uttered, it got a noble burst of applause from the villagers. Yet there isn't a ray of sense in it, or meaning to it. McClintock finished his education at Yale in 1843, and came to Hartford on a visit that same year. I have talked with men who at that time talked with him, and felt of him, and knew he was real. One needs to remember that fact, and to keep fast hold of it. It is the only way to keep McClintock's book from undermining one's faith in McClintock's actuality. As to the book, the first four pages are devoted to an inflamed eulogy of woman, simply woman in general, or perhaps as an institution wherein, among other compliments to her details, he pays a unique one to her voice. He says it fills the breast with fond alarms, echoed by every rill. It sounds well enough, but it is not true. After the eulogy he takes up his real work and the novel begins. It begins in the woods, near the village of Sunflower Hill. Brightening clouds seem to rise from the mist of the fair Chattahoochee, to spread their beauty over the thick forest, to guide the hero whose bosom beats with aspirations to conquer the enemy that would tarnish his name, and to win back the admiration of his long-tried friend. It seems a general remark, but it is not general. The hero mentioned is the to-be hero of the book, and in this abrupt fashion, and without name or description, he is shoveled into the tale. With aspirations to conquer the enemy that would tarnish his name is merely a phrase flung in for the sake of the sound. Let it not mislead the reader. No one is trying to tarnish this person. No one has thought of it. The rest of the sentence is also merely a phrase. The man has no friend as yet, and of course has had no chance to try him, or win back his admiration, or disturb him in any other way. The hero climbs up over Ani's mountain, and down the other side, making for an old Indian castle which becomes the red man's hut in the next sentence. And when he gets there at last, he envies with wonder and astonishment the invisible structure, which time has buried in the dust, and thought to himself his happiness was not yet complete. One doesn't know why it wasn't, nor how near it came to being complete, nor what was still wanting to round it up and make it so. Maybe it was the Indian, but the book does not say. At this point we have an episode. Beside the shore of the brook, sat a young man, about 18 or 20, who seemed to be reading some favorite book, and who had a remarkably noble countenance, eyes which betrayed more than a common mind. This of course made the youth a welcome guest, and gained him friends in whatever condition of his life he might be placed. The traveler observed that he was a well-built figure which showed strength and grace in every movement. He accordingly addressed him in quite a gentlemanly manner, and inquired of him the way to the village. After he had received the desired information, and was about taking his leave, the youth said, "Are you not Major Alfonso, the great musician, too, the champion of a noble cause, the modern Achilles, who gained so many victories in the Florida War?" "I bear that name," said the major, "and those titles, trusting at the same time that the ministers of grace will carry me triumphantly through all my laudable undertakings. And if," continued the major, "you, sir, are the patronizer of noble deeds, I should like to make you my confidant, and learn your address." The youth looked somewhat amazed, bowed low, mused for a moment, and began, "My name is Roswell. I have been recently admitted to the bar, and can only give a faint outline of my future success in that honorable profession. But I trust, sir, like the eagle, I shall look down from the lofty rocks upon the dwellings of man, and shall ever be ready to give you any assistance in my official capacity, and whatever this muscular arm of mine can do, whenever it shall be called from its buried greatness." The major grasped him by the hand, and exclaimed, "Exclamation point, thou exalted spirit of inspiration, thou flame of burning prosperity, may the heaven-directed blaze be the glare of thy soul, and battle down every rampart that seems to impede your progress." There is a strange sort of originality about McClintock. He imitates other people's styles, but nobody can imitate his, not even an idiot. Other people can be windy, but McClintock blows a gale. Other people can blubber sentiment, but McClintock spews it. Other people can mishandle metaphors, but only McClintock knows how to make a business of it. McClintock is always McClintock. He is always consistent. His style is always his own style. He does not make the mistake of being relevant on one page and irrelevant on another. He is irrelevant on all of them. He does not make the mistake of being lucid in one place and obscure in another. He is obscure all the time. He does not make the mistake of slipping in a name here and there that is out of character with his work. He always uses names that exactly and fantastically fit his lunatics. In the matter of undeviating consistency, he stands alone in authorship. It is this that makes his style unique, and entitles it to a name of its own, McClintockian. It is this that protects it from being mistaken for anybody else's. Uncredited quotations from other writers often leave a reader in doubt as to their authorship, but McClintock is safe from that accident. An uncredited quotation from him would always be recognizable. When a boy 19 years old, who had just been admitted to the bar, says, "I trust, sir, like the eagle, I shall look down from lofty rocks upon the dwellings of man," we know who is speaking through that boy. We should recognize that note anywhere. There be myriads of instruments in this world's literary orchestra, and a multitudinous confusion of sounds that they make, wherein fiddles are drowned, and guitars smothered, and one sort of drum mistaken for another sort. But whensoever the brazen note of the McClintockian trombone breaks through that fog of music, that note is recognizable, and about it there can be no blur of doubt. The novel now arrives at the point where the major goes home to see his father. When McClintock wrote this interview, he probably believed it was pathetic. The road which led to the town presented many attractions. Alfonso had bid farewell to the youth of deep feeling, and was now wending his way to the dreaming spot of his fondness. The south winds whistled through the woods, as the waters dashed against the banks, as rapid fire in the pent furnace roars. This brought him to remember while alone, that he quietly left behind the hospitality of a father's house, and gladly entered the world, with higher hopes than are often realized. But as he journeyed onward, he was mindful of the advice of his father, who had often looked sadly on the ground, when tears of cruelly deceived hope moistened his eyes. Alfonso had been somewhat a dutiful son. Yet fond of the amusements of life, had been in distant lands, had enjoyed the pleasure of the world, and had frequently returned to the scenes of his boyhood, almost destitute of many of the comforts of life. In this condition, he would frequently say to his father, "Have I offended you, that you look upon me as a stranger, and frown upon me with stinging looks? Will you not favor me with the sound of your voice? If I have trampled upon your veneration, or have spread a humid veil of darkness around your expectations, send me back into the world, where no heart beats for me, where the foot of man had never yet trod. But give me at least one kind word, allow me to come into the presence sometimes of thy winter-worn locks. Orbit it, heaven, that I should be angry with thee," answered the father, "my son, and yet I send thee back to the children of the world, to the cold charity of the combat, and to a land of victory. I read another destiny in thy countenance, I learned thy inclinations from the flame that has already kindled in my soul a strange sensation. It will seek thee, my dear Alfonso, it will find thee. Thou canst not escape that lighted torch, which shall blot out from the remembrance of men a long train of prophecies which they have foretold against thee. I once thought not so. Once, I was blind. But now the path of life is plain before me, and my sight is clear. Yet, Alfonso, return to thy worldly occupation, take again in thy hand that chord of sweet sounds, struggle with the civilized world, and with your own heart. Fly swiftly to the enchanted ground, let the night owl send forth its screams from the stubborn oak, let the sea sport upon the beach, and the stars sing together. But learn of these, Alfonso, thy doom, and thy hiding place. Our most innocent as well as our most lawful desires must often be denied us, that we may learn to sacrifice them to a higher will. Remembering such admonitions with gratitude, Alfonso was immediately urged by the recollection of his father's family to keep moving. McClintock has a fine gift in the matter of surprises, but as a rule they are not pleasant ones, they jar upon the feelings. His closing sentence in the last quotation is of that sort. It brings one down out of the tinted clouds into sudden and collapsed fashion. It incenses one against the author for a moment. It makes the reader want to take him by his winter-worn locks, and trample on his veneration, and deliver him over to the cold charity of combat, and blot him out with his own lighted torch. But the feeling does not last. The master takes again in his hand that concord of sweet sounds of his, and one is reconciled, pacified. His steps became quicker and quicker. He hastened through the piney woods, dark as the forest was, and with joy he very soon reached the little village of repose, in whose bosom rested the boldest chivalry. His close attention to every important object, his modest questions about whatever was new to him, his reverence for wise old age, and his ardent desire to learn many of the fine arts, soon brought him into respectable notice. One mild winter day, as he walked along the streets toward the academy, which stood upon a small eminence, surrounded by native growth, some venerable in its appearance, others young and prosperous, all seemed inviting, and seemed to be the very place for learning as well as for genius, to spend its research beneath its spreading shades. He entered its classic walls in the usual mode of southern manners. The artfulness of this man. None knows so well as he, how to pique the curiosity of the reader and how to disappoint it. He raises the hope, here, that he is going to tell all about how one enters a classic wall in the usual mode of southern manners. But does he? No, he smiles in his sleeve, and turns aside to other matters. The principal of the institution begged him to be seated, and listen to the recitations that were going on. He accordingly obeyed the request, and seemed to be much pleased. After the school was dismissed, and the young hearts regained their freedom, with the songs of the evening, laughing at the anticipated pleasures of a happy home, while others tittered at the actions of the past day, he addressed the teacher in a tone that indicated a resolution with an undaunted mind. He said he had determined to become a student, if he could meet with his approbation. Said he, I have spent much time in the world. I have traveled among the uncivilized inhabitants of America. I have met with friends, and combated with foes, but none of these gratify my ambition, or decide what is to be my destiny. I see the learned world have an influence with the voice of the people themselves. The despoilers of the remotest kingdoms of the earth refer their differences to this class of persons. This the illiterate and inexperienced little dream of. And now if you will receive me as I am, with these deficiencies, with all my misguided opinions, I will give you my honor, sir, that I will never disgrace the institution, or those who have placed you in this honorable station. The instructor, who had met with many disappointments, knew how to feel for a stranger who had been thus turned upon the charities of an unfeeling community. He looked at him earnestly, and said, Be of good cheer, look forward, sir, to the high destination you may attain. Remember, the more elevated the mark at which you aim. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.